It's both the biggest competitive point inside the industry is people competing to get copywriters. And it's also, you know, unfortunately, our biggest extra industry risk is that copy is the thing that gets the FTC upset when it gets too aggressive if it's not being managed. And so most of the copywriting courses out there and people teaching copy kind of miss something very fundamental, which is, can you make an argument? Can you like build a thesis? You have a basic thesis about an idea and support it, right? And so there's always this balance between this is the big mainstream story, but the mainstream story is good for grabbing people's attention and really shitty for grabbing people's wallets.
Hey there, John. Thanks for joining the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. It's good to see you again. We've met briefly, but a lot of our audience doesn't know much about you or the industry that you work in. So we want to give people kind of the financial publishing industry, the financial newsletter industry one-on-one here on this podcast. Give them the history, give them the basics. I think it's really fascinating. It applies a lot to what we do in the newsletter space. So let's do that. So like start us off with who you are, what you do, and then your background.
Yeah, sure. So my name is John Newton. I run the Financial Marketing Summit, which is the it's the marketing conference for the financial publishing industry. And when we say the financial publishing industry, our conception of it is a combination of the stock newsletter world and like trader education kind of world. And so kind of like the current state of the industry is that we have a few large players that are, when I say large player, their revenues are in the hundreds of millions on subscription sales. And then we have dozens and dozens of smaller pubs in anywhere from 1 to 30 million, right? And then you have like the whole media ecosystem around that. The way I came into the industry was as a copywriter, right? Because subscription sales is very much driven by long form copy, whether it's written or video promos. Came back in, I think about 2005, under a guy named Clayton Makepeace, who was this amazing copywriter going back into the direct mail days of the industry. Actually launched the supplement industry too in the 90s with his copy, or the health newsletter industry. And, you know, I started in copy, did a lot of trader education, affiliate launches, stuff like that, had some big wins up, you know, like in the $11.5 million in sales on a campaign range. Ended up starting a conference for the space because there wasn't one. And I've been running that for about a decade now, work with all the big publishers. And when I think of like the way I tell people about the industry, I say the Motley Fool, because everyone's familiar with that brand. Right? They started in the 90s, actually in the AOL chat rooms of all places. So it's an industry that predates the internet in a lot of ways, because it goes back to these are 50s, really. And it started out where originally a lot of wealth managers and financial advisors started writing newsletters almost as a self-marketing kind of thing. And so we have people operating today, like the oldest is probably like Martin Weiss, who's literally been in the industry for 50 years himself personally. And so it's a long history. And then when the internet came around, obviously it switched from direct mail to digital. And the first big e-letters actually started with like the Agora groups and people like that in the Motley Fool, because they realized, hey, like it's direct mail, but free. At the time, it didn't cost you anything to send anything out. Acquisition was dirt cheap. I mean, in fact, acquisition was profitable. I mean, this is back in the days where like you could advertise on Google pay-per-click, arbitrage a click to somebody else's co-reg after it got your offer, or the person got your offer, and just the advertising from that co-reg or that redirect would be more money than you paid for the click. And so it was wildly profitable in the early days. And yeah, it's, you know, 24 years later since those things really started, and we've had lots of ups and downs in the industry, but it's been consistently growing. And yeah, I mean, I can go whatever direction you want from there.
Yeah, but let's break down some of that stuff. So maybe it'd be good to start with, tell us about the three biggest companies in the financial publishing space. You mentioned one of them, I believe.
Yeah, the Motley Fool is the most commonly understood one. There's the Agora companies, which is really like an ecosystem of companies. It's you know, we refer to them as the Agora group, but really what it is it's a kind of like a holding company with a centralized services business that would then launch or support other publishers that it grow up, most of them internally, right? And Bill Bonner founded that. He's like a legendary direct response marketer, legend in this industry. He's, you know, in his 70s now, a billionaire from newsletters. And they're at their height of the business. That company probably did about $1.3 billion in subscription sales.
When do you think that height was? Was that 2020?
2020 to 21. was the, but that was a little bit before that. What happened in the interim was one of the groups that kind of, we used to associate with Agora, but was technically partnership between Bill Bonner and Porter Stansberry, Stansberry Research, split out. Porter started basically doing the same thing in terms of building or spinning up new publishing businesses underneath his brand. And that grew into what is now called MarketWise, which is the only publicly traded company in our space. They, in 2021, did about, which was a boom, boom year, did about 500 and something million. This year, they're way down. There's a bunch of factors to that, but they're still like, you know, pushing 300, right?
Impressive. And then tell us, what do you think top line revenue is for The Motley Fool?
That's much harder. So The Motley Fool's got a different business model. Their newsletter business is twofold in the sense that they have an advertising model and they have a subscription model. And they took a very different approach both in how they built their business and what they decided to do with their business. They're much more standoffish with their numbers, right? So I don't have a clear number on them. Whereas MarketWise is public information. Agora, I'm just very intimate with lots of the folks in the company. And they're also very, you know, willing to share stuff like that.
Yeah. Would it be safe to estimate their
at times, I think they peaked somewhere over around 100 at some point on the newsletter side with, you know, but how that breaks down with advertising and subscriptions is very difficult for me to judge. But they also developed, you know, wealth management business and other kind of ancillary divisions, right?
Yeah, it's helpful to understand the scale of these things because I think most people have no clue. You know, we'll call it the newsletter first media company space. We know what some of the acquisitions have been for like Morning Brew or Industry Driver Axios, but we don't know a lot about the numbers in this space, or at least most of our listeners don't. So it's helpful to get an overview. I would love to like get a basic overview of what these companies do for customers, how they make money, just the basic services and content that they're providing.
Sure. So the basic product model, right, for a newsletter, financial newsletter company, we split up between what we call front and back ends. A front end product is usually a relatively low priced product. It's anywhere from 39 to 100 and change. And that is we use it as an acquisition letter, right? And so it is, in many cases, the best newsletter they produce, right? It's the thing that customers come in on. But the purpose of that product is twofold. It's one, to identify a paying customer in external media and subsidize the cost of the media to acquire them, right? So you want to kind of break even at some point on this customer, and having that initial product sale to, you know, it tells you two things. It's like, this guy's willing to spend money for this type of information. And, you know, you apply that sale to the initial media spends. And so that product, generally speaking, is a monthly newsletter, right? It's a big, you have a guru who is giving you a big analysis, and there's a single issue traditionally each month that has kind of his take on some aspect of the market. Right, the stock market, and then he'll have model portfolios in there, right? So he'll have kind of like a basic portfolio that will buy recommendations, sell recommendations, and so that you're getting kind of his picks on stocks, and it will be a running thing that goes. And there's variation on that, right? If you have a trading system, it's going to have more active content because the markets are faster if you're a trader versus if you're like a value investor type of person. But that's the basic thing, and then the back end products, which, you know, get up to, you know,
and before you get into the back end, is this all digital now, or is there still being print
newsletters? Most occasionally, you'll find people who still print, and the reason that you would still print is it's another marketing channel, right? Even the fulfillment is really strong marketing channel, and so what they'll do in some cases, and it's not as common as it used to be, is they'll still print and mail a newsletter or a supplement to the newsletter, something that is valuable, so that people will want to open and read it, and then they'll put inserts for other things in that, back-end products, new launches, things like that. But it's much less common than it was before, not because it didn't work, doesn't continue to work, but because you need staff for that, and just one of those things that's more of like an ancillary revenue thing than it is. And there's some groups who still are very active with that, because then they'll also direct mail to what we call the house file of customers for their back-ends.
Got it.
And so a back-end product is usually it's more of the same, right? So there's a world view that's presented in the front-end product, and the back-end is some variation on that. And so if you have a trading system or investing system, for instance, then the front-end product will often be like kind of the big blue chips, that they'll, you know, big obvious things that are safer bets. And then one way that you'll split the black end up is it will be in terms of risk in the market, right? So like blue chips and big stocks are a safer bet. Micro caps are much higher risk, but higher potential rewards. So the service on the back end might be a micro cap version of the front end product, but it's a higher price one. Or it could be an active trading strategy. And so depending on what that is, the fulfillment of that will change, right? In some cases, it's very similar to the front end. In other cases, it's a trading service that you're getting much more active, weekly emails about like the markets with, again, buy and sell recommendations. And so the front to back end kind of meta is often about risk in the newsletter side. The trader education side, that is a little bit more course dependent. It goes by based on proximity to the guru, right? So the front end product will be something that like, here's how to do it. The next level product will be like, well, here, let's do it kind of, or let me teach you my system a little bit more in depth. And then the next level would be like, hey, why don't we get on a call once a month? You go through my course materials that are really in depth, and then I'll get on a group webinar and we'll answer your questions on up to like, in-person boot camps, right? And so the price ranges on the back ends on both sides go up to $20,000-$30,000, right?
And what do some of those lower price back ends look like? Because that might be like the higher end of some of the back ends, but what are the more typical ones priced at?
A typical newsletter is somewhere in the $2,000-$3,000 range. They're sold with the upsells are very important, right? Because, if you add a two-year option, you're going to get, 10 to 40% uptake on that. And so you're moving money forward, right? So you're just trying to get as much sales right now as possible on the people that came in. And so you're trying to move that money as far forward as possible. And so it'd be, $2,000 to $2,500, sometimes, $3,000 or $299.95 or whatever. And for an annual subscription, and then they'll have usually either a lifetime offer, which is not as common as it was, or just a two-year. So
immediately after you buy that $2,000 per year subscription, you'll be offered a lifetime subscription.
It'd be in the order process.
In the order process. After you check out the next page.
In the checkout process itself.
Oh, in the checkout process.
Before you put your credit card in, it'd be on the same page, or it could be an immediate upsell that before you complete the thing. But you want, if you're going to do upsells, you want to have it in that initial thing as much as possible, where you can add more after that, but in some groups have, but like the closer you can have it in there, like the 1 and 2 year option built into the order page, or the lifetime option built into the order page, the better.
And that's to increase, you mentioned this already, but to increase average order value so you can grow faster, spend more on marketing, invest more. What do you typically see? This is tactical, but like, what's the multiple on like a lifetime membership? Is a lifetime membership like 3 times the annual membership? Like how do those?
No, actually, that's the thing is, and this is the reason that people went to the 2 years. They often found that the pricing, it was around the 2 year price or a discounted 2 year price. And so it was more of a, we're just going to do this. Our average lifetime value on a customer is X. And if we do this, it's better. So that's one of the reasons that the 2 year went down. Now there is another lifetime model that is one really high price followed by a $200 to $500 a year maintenance fee, right? So here's a $5,000 product or a $35,000 product, and you're going to pay $X a year kind of as a maintenance fee on that. As long as you're doing that, you don't have to pay anything else, right? So that's another way to kind of structure it.
Yeah, it's interesting. So high price one time and then lower price to maintain that. Mm. And then I want to make sure I'm clear on this. So when you're selling a two-year subscription, what do people sell that for? Is it like 1.5 times a 1 year?
You take half off the second year.
Okay. I just want to see what that I find price.
Yeah. So that way you turn, you increase your, you go from a $2,000 product to a $3,000 sale, right?
So, okay. Super helpful.
And talking about like the top of the funnel and like acquisition, what are generally the highest volume acquisition channels for FinPub groups? So bringing folks into the funnel to start.
Yeah. So one thing that's nice about FinPub at this point, and a lot of this actually happened around our conference because we created a space for everybody to get together, is we have a lot of niche-specific media sources, really substantial ones. Like I think you interviewed Matt Paulson from MarketBeat, really phenomenal media source for the industry. But by and large, Google, display, like the big media buyers, they're going out wherever they can get the volume, right? And the most volume is going to be on those big display networks. Facebook was big for a while. It's still used. We have a community of very aggressive kind of media buyers. We're really smart, who are basically always trying to find where the volume is. And, you know, that's the hardest part of the business, is getting promotions that work at scale for those groups. And so it is, it's, you know, it is a constant kind of, you know, war going on, not war, but just, it's a constant problem, right? Like, some groups might go for a year, but they don't have a good front end or more that can get them a lot of volume. So they'll have a lot of small, low volume because the copy is so important to their ability to scale.
And that's interesting, because I've seen a lot of display for Finn, but like Motley Fool, for example, you see a lot of display ads. And would you say that like the tactic is generally like the advertorial, like kind of the long sales letter? What do those ads look like generally?
Yeah. So there's two approaches, and it is there is a movement towards more lead gen, right? This is where it's a long form promo. So it's going to be an advertorial or a video sales letter of some kind. Sometimes they'll just have a report that the advertorial like might, you know, end in a promo, but it's, you know, some version of that, right? There'll be traffic driver going to a sales page. If they can get the opt-in, you know, a lead gen model, then it's still pushing to a sales page on the first day. And the numbers on that, and you know, that's one thing, nice thing about working with people who can scale, is they have really good data on this. And I've never seen anybody who was like, well, we put the sales page in early and it didn't work as well. Now, that doesn't mean that like everybody who doesn't buy is a bad lead. In some cases, you'll find that people who just come in on pure lead gen and don't buy, they build over time into better buyers because they build the relationship first before they buy, whereas some people kind of just like buy and that urge is gone. And so both models work. We do see a lot more lead gen these days. Some people still do like straight to sales, but like that sales piece is critical within that early funnel.
And when you say lead gen, you're just talking about collecting the email up front and then doing the selling in some sort of an email sequence afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because for a long time, it was straight, like, we advertised the sales page and you either buy or you don't buy. There was no option to opt in. And there was for a period of time, there was a lot of, like, different worldviews on that. Right? Like, a paying customer is worth more fundamentally than a non-paying customer. And so, that gets into issues of tracking, attribution, and all the other stuff that kind of, you know, if you don't know whether these leads, if you can't attribute these leads very well, then it's really hard for you to make a judgment on a traffic source. And so in that case, going straight to sale gives you much better data.
Yeah. And you're able to do that because you have this low end, low priced front end product. You know, it's under $100. You're not selling, you know, $2,000 on a sales page right away. So it makes a lot of sense to send people straight to a sales page or a VSL. And then just to clarify, if people are doing lead gen or they're collecting email addresses, they're going straight to a sales page or a VSL after they enter their email, right?
In most cases. It's very, very much like the welcome emails will link to something or they'll be able to redirect to it. It's very sales dependent.
Yeah, and that's like a common mistake we see in our space, where people, they collect an email address, there's a thank you page that just says, thanks, and you know, that's it, and there's no offer there. And so I just wanted to clarify that for people who are maybe a little bit new to this. One more question on the funnel, and maybe Ryan, maybe we could talk the whole call about the funnel, which is fine with me. But so after they buy that front end offer for $50 to $100 per year, what happens after that? Are they immediately upsell to the back end right after they buy on like a one click upsell page, or how does that work? How do they get them from front end buyer to back end buyer?
Yeah, they basically often, what you'll have is a theme. If they're having a funnel, it'd just be an email series that. We're not as funnel, just as a aside, we're not as funnel driven as other spaces. And you have a series, they'll buy the product. And once they're on that list, they're going to get put on a few lists, right? They're going to get put on a free list for the business that is a daily email. The product itself nowadays often has, increasingly, you'll have like a newsletter for that guru that is going out regularly to the free people or just to the paid customers, like all paid customers get it. And so they're going to end up on a couple of lists. That by being on there, they'll get sponsored ads in content. They'll get dedicated emails sent out to them relatively quickly. We're going to always be selling kind of business. And so there's always a promo going out every week. You're going to have promos going out. You're going to have multiple backends. Any editor, generally speaking, has, you know, 3 to 5 backend products at this point. And that's very important to the math of the business. to have multiple backends. And so they're going to get into, you know, the nice thing about investing in trading is it's a very information dependent thing. And so there's lots of content going out all the time, both in the free and the paid side. And within that, there's lots of promo as well.
That's interesting. Like, why, this is maybe obvious to some people, but why have multiple backend offers? Can you elaborate on that?
From a pure like sales perspective, people will keep buying. That's one reason. The other reason is that there's a lot of stuff going on in the markets, and there's a lot of different ways to trade in the markets and a lot of different strategies. And so like creating a product for like, you know, I have my, you know, Magic Strategy 1 and Magic Strategy 1 applied now to, you know, small caps. Here's an options version of it. Here's a different version of it, right? So you can do that and deliver different types of value to people who are really into it. But the thing is that your best customers are multi-buyers. And if you don't have multiple products, you'll never find out who those guys are. And you'll never figure out the limit of what people are willing to spend with you and how long, you know. So if you're just purely on a retention model and you have, you know, one front-end product, one back-end product that's a good business, you're going to just miss out on a lot of revenue, like a lot of revenue if you do that. Often what we'll find even is a new product launch will generate the most revenue. And so you'll have products that you launched. They've been good for a couple years. The kind of story of the product, the story of the market has changed. We'll shutter that product right at the end of, like, stop selling it at some point, and then they close it off and they launch a new product. And that generates another big influx of sales from often a lot of the same people who were interested in the other product, but now the market's changed and there's a different story. And so that element of having multiple backend products is just a huge profit driver.
Shifting gears just for a second, I know you mentioned that your background is in copywriting, John, and I know that in the FinPub space in particular, kind of the long sales letter, a lot of the success of the businesses is around how good your copy is for a letter like that. We both worked for Sam Parr, who is a big fan of like the sales letter as well. I'm curious, do you have a short list of like the best sales letters that you've read or resources that you point folks to? Or any just copywriters that maybe our audience might not be aware of that they should be following?
Well, the problem is a lot of the copywriters that are really active and working in this space don't have any public presence. There are guys who they're running businesses, they're running teams. There are amazing copywriters like Patrick Bavay, who like Mike Palmer is a legend in the business, but you never see much publicly from him. Every now and again, you'll find some stuff. You have guys like Angel Suarez, him and Aaron DeHoe, who's a publisher over at Banyan Hill. They had a $10 million day, which is like the biggest single sales day for a launch that we've had. You have just like, there's so many of them. I mean, Jed Canty was just a spectacular copywriter. There's so many people you just never hear of because they're working in the business. Evaldo Albuquerque, he has a book. I'm trying to think, do I have it? Oh, here it is. This is the 16-word sales letter.
Yeah, it's a great book. Right?
Evaldo is one of the higher-selling copywriters ever. He's just in one of the fastest producing. Fantastic story. You know, English isn't even his first language, and he's just he's crushed it. He's kind of like what I think other people in the space have. He's just a supreme talent. Is the phrase you hear thrown about it for him. And so you have, there's just these amazing writers out there. It is a very copy dependent business. It's probably the biggest, it's both the biggest kind of competitive point inside the industry is people competing to get good copywriters. And it's also, you know, unfortunately, our biggest extra industry risk is that copy is the thing that gets the FTC upset when it gets too aggressive, if it's not being managed. And so, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword.
Are there any historic sales letters that, like, because I find one of the best ways to learn is to read good copy. Right, or even like do copy work.
Oh yeah.
Any ones that you like that come to mind, or like places that you go? I know swipe.co is one that has some of these.
I'm fortunate to have a spectacularly large personal swipe file. But like there are some just amazing letters. Like, you know, you go back to Bill Bonner launched a company called International Living, which is a travel newsletter that's launched in the 70s and is still running today. And there is a basic letter that he wrote then in direct mail that they still use versions of today for International Living. And it's, you can probably find it. I can find it and send it to you. There was like some classic, like in the Magalog days, there were all these amazing promos, like, you know, Ignore Trying to Lose Money was this great one. There was the, you know, Clayton Makepeace's Supernet, Amazon.com. Porter Stansberry wrote, he basically, the story of how he launched Stansberry was he basically got Bill Bonner to invest $36,000 back in the 90s to mail his promotion that he wrote when he showed it to him. And the promotion was, there's a new railroad across America, right? And so it was a throwback to the robber barons, like the you know, building the railroads, but he was talking about the, you know, internet cables. And so you have these promos that are just these like kind of magical kind of ideas out there. And every great copywriter has a style, and you know, in the space, you start to realize they have a style. And so there are a ton of great promos, and I can probably pull together some for you that you'd be able to share if you want.
That'd be helpful. I was going to ask, how do you learn copywriting, but how do you learn financial copywriting? Like how do you do it, and what do you recommend for people now who are interested in this?
Yeah, so financial copywriting is a couple of things. First is, most of the copywriting courses out there and people teaching copy kind of missed something very fundamental, which is, can you make an argument? Can you like build a thesis? Can you have a basic thesis about an idea and support it, right? And if you understand how to do that, the best way to learn copy is to then go deconstruct successful promos. Like, it's less on like, you know, studying other people's courses, and it's more on like breaking down a promo. How did this promo get structured? What's the sequence of ideas? What are the promises here, and how do they support that promise, right? And that's where you actually see like the footprint or the stylistic differences between copywriters. Is the way that they structure and prove their arguments is different. And that is, to me, like everyone that I know, and I'm fortunate to have a lot of friends who are just like some of the best copywriters in the world. And everybody I know that is a true A-level copywriter like that has gone through some version of that process of deconstructing promos. Yeah, you might buy all the courses, read the books, but unless you do that thing, you're probably never going to get that great. And so that, more than anything else, is the big thing. Now, the issue of understanding financial markets is a much bigger problem. We have that problem too in the industry. You know, during we had the longest bull market in history, right? From 2009 up until 21. And we had a lot of copywriters that got really lazy, or who came into the business, not lazy, just came into the business during a time when Bitcoin was going straight up. And they were able to just kind of ride on copy that's just like, here's how to make 3,000%, right? And then when they couldn't do that anymore, they struggled. And so Porter and some other folks in the business have over the years like put together lists of like, everybody who wants to learn how to write in financial, here's a bunch of finance books to read, right? One of the best things you can do is go to BerkshireHathaway.com, Warren Buffett's company. He publishes all of his letters. Start at the first one and read forward, and you'll get an amazing history of financial markets from Warren Buffett's perspective, and an amazing way to look at the markets, right? There's, you know, a ton of books. If you're going to write for a particular editor, the best thing to do is, you know, you're going to engage with him as much as he's willing to. Ask him what his influences were, what books he recommends. Go through like books, read up subject by subject based on when you're writing a promo, and you find all these amazing stories. And you can always tell when there's a new copywriter, because the same stories that grabbed you, they get excited about, right? Like stuff like the Turtle Traders and, you know, the Quantum Fund and stuff. You'll see the same kind of stories come up because they are, within just the history of markets, remarkable stories. And the first time you come across them, you're like, I got to write a promo about this. Unfortunately, every other copywriter who came across it wrote a story about it too. So it's not new to the market, but it's new to them. And so you see like the level of like engaging things. And this is where like it's one of the hardest things about financial, right? Is understanding the markets in a way that you can be, from a promotional standpoint, understanding the markets in a way that you can understand what the big ideas are and present them in an exciting and interesting way. And so one of the core kind of beliefs in the industry and kind of models is looking for big themes, right? So the way you structure your product, and this is product before promo, often is a guru is going to have two or three big trends or themes that he focuses on, right? Maybe it's the rise of crypto and all the things that are happening with that. Maybe, you know, back in the early 2000s, it was the rise of China. Maybe it's biotech, whatever it is. There's going to be a handful of trends within that. Like if you're a biotech letter, you're going to have a few major health trends and ideas that they follow. And then the promos then are the interesting fringe things around that idea, things that people don't know. And so there's always this balance between, this is the big mainstream story, but the mainstream story is good for grabbing people's attention. and really shitty for grabbing people's wallets, right? Because I can get all the free information about this trend. And so we're always kind of threading the needle on, here's this big trend that everyone just knows about and can get your attention, but here's the part of that story nobody knows, right? And so Mike Palmer, who I mentioned before, he's actually, he was like the copy chief over at Stansberry. And not only is he a legend, but he's trained a series of legends in the business. One of the things that he said one time that always stuck with me was kind of each promo becomes like, what's the next part of the story that hasn't been told? You're always like, what's the part of the story that hasn't been told? And what's, and after that's told, what's the next one, right? And so you're looking for these trends that have like multi-year spans. And then you keep telling the new part of the story in that trend, right? And so the editorial and the copy pieces, in the best cases, in practice, it doesn't always work this way, but in this kind of the ideal scenario, they meld together to where somebody comes in on this big idea promo, and that big idea is then fulfilled and talked about further in the actual product and developed over time, because that's what they came in on. And there's only a handful of ideas that anyone's going to have that they talk about on a regular basis, because one, it gives customers clarity, it gives structure and form to the letter, and it kind of like allows you to be the person for this thing, right? So that position and credibility is kind of important.
Can you quickly break down what do you mean by a big idea? I think a lot of people won't know that term as well.
Yeah, big idea. So there's a lot of different ways to break down what that is, right? But I think one of the good examples of it would be like, is this idea worthy of like a 60-minute special, right? Like, would the news do a deep dive on this? Would John Stewart do a deep dive on this subject, right? So when, I don't know how familiar everybody is with like the rise of Bitcoin, right? But this is a good example to use because it goes through. In the early stages, it was the big idea about crypto was it was an alternative currency, right? And people were going to use it to buy pizzas, and everyone who did regrets it now. And like, you were going to use it as untraceable money, and it was a new monetary model. That is a big idea about Bitcoin. Then the big idea changed, and we had the ICO boom, right? And now it was, this is an alternative to stocks in terms of how you raise capital. Because now you can go out, you can raise capital with these coins. And then, of course, you have this massive amount of fraud that caused a whole bunch of problems. But that was a big idea about it. And then you had, and this was, I think, Raoul Paul, who founded Real Vision, put this one out. He put out a paper that said, no, the way to think about Bitcoin is it's like gold, right? It's digital gold, which is a hedge against the mainstream system collapsing, right? And then, so for a while, that was the big idea, and people would dive in on that, and then it changed again. And so you can see with one asset that the big idea on that, what it functionally is, evolved and changed over time. And then within each of those ideas, you would have a dozen sub-ideas about that big idea, right, that you could talk about. So how the big idea is kind of a worldview on how something functions. Now, that's one. There's a lot of other ways to do it. One of the best idea franchises that comes around like a trend was when one publisher launched the National Institute of Cannabis Investors, right? And so it was an association for people who wanted to invest in cannabis companies. And this was written by that copywriter, Jerry Canty. He wrote this promo, which they did a phenomenal job, right? Like, if you remember, John Boehner was a huge opponent of the legalization of marijuana when he was in Congress. And then he gets out and he gets on the board of a cannabis company. And he's like, I was wrong about this. And so they actually got him into the sales webinar in the sales letter and did a big promo and launch around him as why I changed my mind in that cannabis is the future. Another version from that group was they launched Angel Entrepreneurs. It was an angel investing letter. And then they got celebrities like the guys from Shark Tank to come on. And so the idea itself was like a big idea is just like, don't invest in stocks. Invest in private markets. And then there's a bunch of, nuance and small ideas inside that.
Got it.
And there's other ways to take it, but those are just a few probably easily accessible ways to think about it.
Yeah, no, I think that's super helpful for, I know just a lot of folks in our audience are learning more about copywriting. And I think the tips there, and also just the folks that you mentioned they should follow, that I had never heard any of those or a lot of those names. I had read the 16-word sales letter. That's a great book, but definitely some good folks to check out.
There's a bunch more that I'm sure I'm going to be like, I'm going to hear it from people. Why didn't you mention me? Or why didn't you mention this person?
Oh, well, you got to send us a list and maybe we'll share it with the audience. I think that would be super helpful. Curious. So, I mean, obviously there's been this big, especially in the last couple years, a popularization or proliferation of people starting digital media brands. Obviously, like we are super involved in that with newsletters, and we see like platforms like Beehive getting popular and ConvertKit. I'm curious, how has that impacted like financial publication space? How is the space evolving alongside a lot more independent creators? And how do you see it kind of headed towards the future?
Yeah, so we think of it as a super positive development, right? For a bunch of reasons. Like one is the, you think of it like the Substack revolution and everything, like has allowed for people who maybe just had a social account, who are really good analysts, to start up a side hustle, basically, where they're publishing and they're making money. And we know from our side that once you get to a certain point, it's really hard to get past it, right? Because you start to get into things like building teams and building staff, right? So you make $1 million and then maybe I want to make $5 million or $10 million. Well, that transition is more than a lot of people who haven't done it realize. And so a lot of that ground of new talent becomes really amazing recruiting for some of the big publishers, right? Hey, like, we'll come in, maybe we'll buy your letter. And like, there's guys who had $1 million, $2 million business. They got bought by a big publisher, or 80% of the business was bought. They kept 20% upside. The publisher then scaled them to a $30, $40 million business. They made more money with their 20% than they ever made in their 100%, right? Because that publisher has the infrastructure, they have the skills, they have the list, frankly. You have 15 million names. You got a lot of people you can market to.
That's so interesting.
And so, so that's one side. Huge opportunity there. Two, it does add a lot of new energy. There's new potential partners, new potential affiliate partners, people who might do email swaps, a lot of new potential partners. We see like the rise of people doing stuff where they're pulling from new channels that maybe we don't market on as much. So there's a lot of new marketing information and insights and stuff. And so as a whole, we see it as a very positive thing. And then on the other side that I think is interesting is that some of the groups who had some regulatory problems, right? I mentioned like the copy can get too aggressive, and we had several FTC cases. Some of those guys were like, wait, the Morning Brew and the Hustle, like, after all, it's not a bad business just to have an advertising business as well. Right? That's less risk from the regulatory side, especially if people went through really difficult cases. And so I think it inspired some people too that, like, hey, maybe there is more revenue models than just the hyper kind of specific subscription side, or we can add that to a lighter business, right? There's ways to not be as aggressive on the copy side, but we have this other revenue channel. And so then that business here is pretty good. And then we can spin stuff off of that, you know? So I think that's another kind of positive side of it.
Yeah, it's so cool. I hadn't necessarily thought of it that way, but it is so positive sum in that, you know, for these smaller builders, or I guess for the larger kind of groups that you've mentioned, kind of the ones that own a lot of the market share, instead of looking at it from a perspective of, oh, you know, all of these smaller independent creators might be taking more of the market share. It's really an acquisition opportunity because they can maybe go out and buy those lists once they've accumulated and proven out that they can be monetized. And it's great for smaller creators that might be listening to this too, newsletter operators that are building in the financial space, because there could potentially be buyers for their lists down the road if they're able to prove that they can be monetized.
Yeah, and the number of affiliates. So the thing that's interesting about our space, in having had groups like the Agora Companies, who basically got to see across like dozens of brands, right, and see the data and see the buying activity, is that we learned a lot about competition, or what we think of as competition, in that a customer comes in and they buy and they have a buying period. They just buy everything from everybody, right? And there's been a couple of times where a big publisher, you know, they'll cross-market with another publisher in that group, but they can all see the same data. And they found that if they reactivate a customer who was kind of dormant on their file by having somebody else buy that product, right? They responded to somebody else's offer that then reactivated them on their own file. So they ended up getting more money by having somebody else's product sold to their list. Now they take an affiliate commission, but it was really interesting that like you know, it's kind of like it's a hobby, frankly, in a lot of ways. And it's like fishing, you know, it's like you're going to go buy a fishing pole. As soon as you buy that pole, you're going to buy 15 other things because you're in the buying mood. You're back into the hobby. You're excited about it again. And then maybe you go dormant and then you come back. And so we don't have this, like, we don't think of like competition the same way as other people do. I think there's a competition for talent. There's a competition for media sources. Everybody shares. If I have a great promo and you don't, then, you know, take the affiliate money. Like, because right now the ideas that you have are not, for whatever reason, are not converting. And if I have something that's not working and I'm struggling to generate revenue this month, I'd love to find somebody else who has a promo that's converting that I can promote to, right?
Yeah. That one thing I've heard from people in this space is your buyers are buyers. And a lot of people in other industries don't really see it that way.
Yeah.
But it's different in the information space for the reasons you just explained. And also you can participate in that. And the affiliate deals that you do in your industry are a lot smarter than the average ones. A lot of the stuff we work with is like, you'll get a 20 or 40% commission for 6 months or 1 year. And what does it look like in the financial market?
Well, there's a lot of different ways, right? So we'll get just a 50% commission on a promo. And this is usually back ends, right? You don't do front end affiliate offers. You do back end affiliate offers because the prices are higher and it's worth, right? So like, you know, if you have a $2,000 product, then I might take, you know, $1,000 of the sale for my list. Some of the larger groups have pushed that up to 80%, right? Because you want access to my customer base. I might double your customer file for a smaller group. And so they're going to take 80%. That can be really aggressive, obviously. We also have a lot of CPA setups where they'll do this, especially for front ends, where maybe it's a $100 sale, but I'll give you $300 because the customer is more valuable to me than the $100 sale. And I'll just give you that, right? And so a lot of the media buyers will use that, but affiliates can access that too. And so that's the, you know, the most common kind of things that we've seen.
Yeah. And those are great. They're just way better than many of like the software deals out there that end after 1 year, or even like financial product, you know, brokerages and financial products.
Yeah.
And Mark could be like, we talked to Matt Paulson a week or two ago or 2 weeks ago.
He's phenomenal.
And he's phenomenal at really both those types of deals, but especially the CPA deals. That's like 90% of their business, and it's $40 million business.
Yeah, because then you can get the Evaltos of the world and the Mike Palmas of the world. You can get their promos monetizing your file, right? And so if you can't get those writers, which you can't, they're so hard to, even the big groups compete for them, you can still get the benefit of their skill sets, right?
Yeah, we talked about this on our podcast, drama, like, you know, we talked about how the Motley Fool is one of the biggest advertisers in Morning Brew, like a top three or top mm-hmm. five. Same in The Hustle too, they were a big advertiser there. So there's lots of ways to collaborate, whether it's affiliate, ad partnerships, the list goes on.
Yeah, no, it's when people come into the space, there's always like, you always have the same set of objections, right? First is like, well, shouldn't this copy be shorter? It's like, not if you want it to sell. And then another one is this like, oh, I got to protect my customers. Nobody can have access to my customers. And I was like, that's just garbage. Like, your customers are probably, you're going to make more money usually if you start to do deals and work with people. The one place where I would say you'd be cautious is you protect your credibility, right? Your integrity. So don't promote something just because it's converting if you fundamentally don't believe in it. That's where you get into more problems, right? Like, you want to protect the relationship that you have with your list, not necessarily be the only one that's getting any money out, because that is something that you can't really get back. And this is fundamentally their relationship businesses. You're building relationships with those customers. And if you ruin that, then you kind of kill the golden goose.
Yeah, that's really important to note. And I think a lot of people have this like tech mindset where like they're selling software when they're not. They're selling, you know, services and information. It's like, you know, it's not winner take all. You know, if someone buys a course about how to grow a newsletter, they're more likely to buy my course about how to grow a newsletter.
Yeah, absolutely. You're selling ideas, you know, and you're selling the person like matters, like the relationship you have with them matters. Like, you know, even in stock investing, it's like you can have three different track records, but and a lot of times the person is like, I want to buy from this guy because I like the way I understand how he looks at the world and I appreciate it. And that matters to me, right? Because it makes sense to me. I think information marketing in general is you're making sense of the world And so people who resonate with the way you see, this is where authenticity actually makes a big difference, is you have to actually see the world in a way that is interesting to other people, and you want to express that to them. And the people who resonate with that are going to become your customers, right? And so, like, having a perspective is important. It's different than the news, right? It's like, or I guess what used to be the news. You've seen this, like, the editorial side of the news has gotten way bigger than, like, reporting, right? It's the personalities that got really big. Because they have a worldview and a perspective, and those things are emotional. And so people follow, like, this guy or that guy. It's Jon Stewart, it's O'Reilly, it's whoever, because they resonate with you.
Yeah, and so it's the same thing there. People are following because they have the same worldview. And that's why some of these, you know, promotions can be not more like political. I don't know if I use that term, but it's like,
oh, some,
if you're a libertarian, you're going to, you know, read about, yeah, like a Bitcoin promotion. It's going to have that big idea related to your libertarian beliefs or your liberal beliefs or whoever it might be. So you're buying it from a guru who has the same worldview as you, or at least, you know, similar, or is introducing you to a worldview that you're interested in, which is kind of novel outside of that space. Yeah, but, you know, it's a really powerful marketing thing that can work outside of FinPub too, you know?
Yeah. Well, it does work outside. I'm like, I think about, like, how many people follow Tesla versus follow Elon Musk? Right? Like, the personality is the thing that grabs the attention and creates the controversy or whatever. And it's the same with Berkshire Hathaway and Warren Buffett, right? Like, everyone, like, Buffett courts the media and always has. He understands the power of it, and he uses it to his benefit. But, like, you follow Berkshire because you follow Buffett. You don't follow Buffett because you follow Berkshire.
Yeah, and Buffett has a very strong point of view on the world and very, you know, clear philosophies that he doesn't bend on. I want to talk about maybe one more big thing, which is FinPub, like, gone wrong, or some places where there's been big successes and then big drops. And because a lot of these promotions are built around a big idea that isn't going to last forever, like we talked about the broadband example that only lasted, you know, a couple of years, for example. Sometimes it's less, sometimes it's around like a bull run in a certain part of a market. I'd love to hear about a story about one of those, like maybe one of the Agora companies that grew really fast and then fell off. We talked about Agora Financial one time. There's probably other examples. Or
yeah, the collapses are less about a promo or trend not working anymore, and what I think could broadly be described as failures in management is how another publisher put it to me. And so, yeah, like Agora Financial was, you know, a phenomenal group in terms of size. I think they were 300 something million per year and change. And then they got hit, like, with a bunch of different things. They had an FTC case, right, for some of the copy that was really aggressive. They, during the Bitcoin boom, they had a massive promo with James Altucher, right? You probably saw it, where
everybody
sold his Bitcoins on his eyes. They spent, like, something like $60 million in 45 days on ads during that, like, hyperbolic move. But then that was when all the ICOs were happening, right? And those were a lot of frauds. And so everything related to Bitcoin got banned off of Google and Facebook for 2 years. And because Agora Financial was running that promo, which was not an ICO, but it was a Bitcoin-related thing, they and pretty much every other Agora got pushed off of Facebook from Google for 2 years. And that hurt a lot. Right. Then there were some issues with, like, refund policies and things like that. And so you had, like, these different waves kind of start to hit the business. And then there was I think more fundamentally, there was a split with the owners and the guys who built it, in the sense that, like, there were the two guys, the staff basically that built the company from almost zero to 300 million didn't have any ownership stake. And then there was some kind of a conflict there. And then they left. Right. And so you had, like, just a series of things that were either, you know, platform related, management related, that basically, like, these are talent driven businesses. And when the talent goes, there's, like, who's going to run the show? Who's going to, you know, you can't just stick anybody in there.
That's fascinating. So it went from 300 million to, does that company exist anymore?
They changed names. They still exist, and they're growing again, but they're a shadow of what they were in that sense. People, like, moved off into other areas and other groups. And so when these groups close down, it's like, we say the group's gone, but a lot of times what happens is the the product gets moved, a lot of the better product and staff get moved into other divisions, right? And so the operating unit is no longer an operating unit, but a lot of the components of that are.
And just out of curiosity, John, when you say it's a talent-based business, are you saying that is the talent in this case like the gurus and the copywriters, and is that kind of, and they move on to other things?
The publisher is actually super important, and the copywriters, but the publisher is at the end of the day the one who is driving which ideas we're going to take. You know, the editor is going to have a ton of ideas, the copywriter is going to have a ton of ideas, but the kind of publisher is the one who is saying, like, this is how we're, you know, these are the things that we're going to push forward, and these are things that we're not. And so they make a lot of decisions that are qualitative based on, you know, the state of the market and kind of the opportunities in front of them. They do, you know, you do have a very, very volatile business in that sense that, you know, if the top guys kind of go, and it's, so the way I look at it is even in a $200 million business, who are the real difference makers, right? It's going to be a handful of copywriters, a couple, in some cases, two, three copywriters that really are the ones that make the difference. You're going to have the marketer whoever's running the marketing teams, who's making all kinds of decisions based on complete and incomplete data and you know, traffic sources, everything else. And then you're going to have the publisher who's kind of tying it all together and saying, these are the things that we're going to promote. These are things that we're not. These are things we're going to green light. Are you willing to take the risk on spending a bunch of money to get a guy from Shark Tank on a promo that could fail, right? Those kind of things, and which when to do those. And so there's a lot of creative risk in there that, like, once you get to a certain scale, and this is a whole other question, is there is a lot of conversation about, did some of these groups just get too big and become unmanageable for a lot within this kind of creative environment, right? That maybe a $200 million publishing brand is a little bit too big, and they should have been four $50 million companies that had separate things. But then again, you have to have the right talent. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff at that scale that is different if you're in a smaller publishing business.
Yeah. We got to wrap up soon, but I have to ask you this one question, and Ryan, if you have to run, feel free to, but how do these companies work with gurus? Like, how are these deals structured? Is, I think, like, James Altucher would be a good example to run through. Not that you have inside info on any of these, there's so many different ones, but, like, how does that work? Like, how do they get these people?
So in some cases, when the person already has a big following, they will usually get some kind of a big revenue cut, right? Most other people will get a really good salary, and then they'll get a bonus or a percentage of the renewal, right? Because the copywriter gets incentivized on the acquisition. The editor is incentivized on the renewed customer because that's somebody who loved it and decided to continue, right? So,
interesting. What type of rep cuts are you seeing for someone who has a following, like a James Altucher?
Yeah, during some of the boom years, they were much bigger. You had people getting, like, you know, 20%+, and that's not common anymore. You'd have to be, they might get a cut of a promo like that where they split it, like, but not of a business as much. And so normally we get a few percentage points, but this is a deal making community, right? And so if you have something special, you can probably negotiate for something. So, like, you know, If a huge star comes in and says, if like Ashton Kutcher is like, I want to do a VC letter, like, you know, you could sell the crap out of that because he does a lot of VC very successfully. He's a celebrity, right? So he's not going to get a crap deal versus somebody who has, like, kind of a niche audience and things like that. So you know, it's a very deal centric thing. The problem with some of those deals, though, is we had a group who did a lot of deals with and this wasn't out the shirt, but it was other people, and they were giving way bigger percentages away, like 50%, right? And so from the publisher's side, it didn't actually work out because they might do a $10 million promo, but they got less profit at the end of the day than a $2 million promo because the half the revenue goes over there, but they still had all the costs. Like, and so, like, one, and that's one of the problems that some of those groups that were financially at is, like, the math doesn't always work. Just because the top line number is bigger, right? Because you have a celebrity or a mini celebrity, or somebody who has a following, you know, it's still at the end of the day about profit, right? And so somebody can do a cash grab for a little while and then the thing goes away versus somebody who has a long-term thing because, like, the deal was more well structured. And so there's been a lot of lessons in the industry. I don't know that those are all bad things. It's just that we had a boom period. It's hard to express how good 2021 was for everybody, right? Other than to say that, like, you know, market wise was north of, I think they pushed 700 million, I think, by themselves in 21.
But that feels like a different time now, the things that were going on in the markets back then.
Exactly.
Yeah, the psychology of everyone.
Yeah, it's cyclical. And so you got to adapt to the cycles. And that's the frustrating part and the fun part of financial.
Yeah. Well, this has been fascinating. Where can people find you? Tell us about, like, your website, the conference.
Yeah, financialmarketingsummit.com. We do it, you know, every year. We do some masterminds too, but we do one big conference for the industry where we get everybody together, do a bunch of content. We're about to launch a community for the industry. We'll have a Discord server and a bunch of other, like, industry-specific training coming out. Should be out in a few weeks. That'll be on the website, so financialmarketingsummit.com. Also, like, I'm very active with people on LinkedIn. You know, for me, it's a business community. And so if you're in financial and you have stuff in that area, like, just John Knutson on LinkedIn, hit me up. Happy to talk. Get to know people, introduce people around in the industry.
Absolutely. We'll link those below in the podcast YouTube description. Go follow John on LinkedIn. Thank you, John. Appreciate
it. Thank you. This is great. Thanks.
Thank you for listening. I hope you're enjoying this podcast. And if you are, we are hosting a live virtual event for podcast listeners. Me and Ryan Carr are going to do a Q&A fireside chat and hang out with our listeners who love the podcast. To get access to that, you just need to do three simple things that will help us grow the podcast faster and reach more people. Number one is to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcast or Spotify. Number two is to subscribe to the YouTube channel. You can find that by searching Matt McGarry on YouTube. That's where we publish the podcast video. And then number three is to send a screenshot of both of those things to me so I can send you an invite. Send that to my email, which is matt@newsletteroperator.com. It's also linked in the podcast description below. And that is it. That's all you need to do to get an invite. We will be doing this live call, or potentially multiple live calls of our listeners, after we reach 100 5-star reviews on Apple Podcast or Spotify and 1,000 YouTube subscribers. So the sooner you do that, the sooner you'll get the invite, and the sooner we'll be able to do this call with you, and it will be a lot of fun. So I hope to see you there.